Paper Trail by Prime Ideal. Ottery St. Ketchbull Prophet, June 2017. Quidditch News. Because it's not fair if kids play against adults or boys against girls all the time, and Grandma gets mad if we do a draft and choose sides, the new rules for Weasley Extended Family Quidditch Tournaments are that we have to randomly pick names out of a hat and switch teams if we do it different days. Anyway, this week's scores were Friday, Purple Dragons 320, Angry Gargoyles 190. Saturday, Spicy Neasels 450, Lazy Lethifolds 310. Sunday, Undead Gnomes 140, Exploding Flowers 80. No snitch catch. Game called for rain. Congratulations to Aunt Angelina and Lucy for being on the winning team in all three games. Pet Report. Uncle Ron and Aunt Hermione's owl, Enigma, had four hatchlings. Unfortunately, as part of a deal with the owl office, they have been returned to Diagon Alley rather than kept as pets. Louis reports that his toad, Titania, can croak in rhythm to Celestina Warbeck songs, but we have not been able to fact-check this. Food Review. While all of Grandma and Grandpa's meals are wonderful and get 7 out of 7 stars, we do have ratings for a new Muggle restaurant in the area, the Duchess's Delight. Grandma and Grandpa give it 7 out of 7 for very good service and willingness to put up with large, all-age parties. Aunt Audrey, our expert on Muggle cuisine, gives it 5 out of 7. Pricey and noisy, but good range of options for picky palates. Aunt Hermione gives it 3 out of 7. No information about food sources or their ethical and environmental impact. Special thanks to Luna Lovegood and the staff of the Quibbler for helping print this special first edition of the OSCP. Hogwarts Monthly Report, March 2025. The Durmstrang Institute has announced a new program for visiting students. According to Headmaster Pavel Nyedin, the Mage Exchange will be for students in a qualified school of magical education who are of age and willing to complete a term of their studies at Durmstrang. Speaking to the Daily Prophet last week, Professor Nyedin said that he expected the first class to be relatively small, perhaps beginning with students from Hogwarts or Beauxbatons. It can be valuable for young people to have others around them who are going through the same thing, to deal with the issues of culture shock. However, in future years, we hope this will branch out to Kalmuth, Hanmunde, and other magical schools. But even though apparition and flu powder make international travel easy, there may be difficulties other than the logistic ones. Especially in European schools, this kind of exchange program calls to mind the infamous Triwizard Tournament, which ran intermittently from 1255 to 1797. While its organizers claimed it would promote friendship and cooperation, the tournament instead became known for mayhem, mishaps, and in several cases, even the death of participants. A modern revival of the tournament in 1994 to 1995 also led to the murder of Hogwarts sixth-year Cedric Diggory during Voldemort's revival. I spoke to Fleur Delacour, Beauxbatons' representative in the 1994 tournament, for her thoughts on the Mage Exchange. "I think it will be good for Durmstrang to do this," she said. "In many ways, they have lagged behind other schools in terms of educating and learning from their Muggle-born peers, so having some outside perspectives could be useful when it comes to acknowledging the diversity of the wizarding world." Would she ever want to see the Triwizard Tournament restarted? Absolutely not. I recognize that this may sound entitled of me. People will say I was lucky to have had that opportunity when nobody in 200 years did. But if academics from 3 prestigious schools couldn't foresee the return of Voldemort, why should we be any smarter these days? Yes, we all hope that Voldemort is really gone, but the early tournaments didn't need dictators to accidentally get people killed. Think of it this way. Cedric isn't here to give his perspective on should the tournament return. So it's my duty, I think, to speak for him. Does restricting the exchange program to of-age witches and wizards make sense? I think so. My younger sister visited Hogwarts during the tournament as part of one of the tasks, but she didn't get to stay long enough to appreciate the experience of taking classes at another school in another language. I think students should be old enough that they're willing to try something new, but not when they're worrying about exams. What Durmstrang's exam system is like, I don't know. Headmistress Sprout has not yet announced whether Hogwarts will participate in the first year of the Mage Exchange, or, if so, what the application process will be like. Whether or not this program is a success, we should admire Professor Nyadin's hopes for greater understanding and friendship across borders, but also remember that those hopes are fragile. Witch Weekly, December 2028. He's been called the Reformer, the Uncrowned King, and the winner of the Most Charming Smile Award. But who is retired Minister of Magic Kingsley Shacklebolt when he's at home? We sat down with him to find out. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Shacklebolt. My pleasure. Let's start with an easy one. What have been the best and worst parts of retirement? Well, the best thing is no longer getting howlers in the mail. The worst thing is that a bunch of the owls whose humans had it out for me earlier are used to flying around my house. I've moved a couple of times since then, but they're clever beasts. Tell us about your early life. What were some of the influences on you growing up? When I tell people that my father was on the Wizengamot and he comes from a very old family, a lot of them will nod their heads and say, "Oh, no wonder you wanted to work for the ministry then." But that's only true in part. It was important for my mother, who's a Muggle-born, to make sure I had relationships with my grandparents and families from that side and be able to speak their language, to understand that there were places in the world where I'd be very at ease and comfortable, and others where I might struggle to fit in and have to take that in stride. At Hogwarts, sometimes I'd get jealous when my classmates spent the summer going to the Quidditch World Cup and I was in Birmingham listening to my cousin's band, which was rubbish, but as I grew up, I realized how valuable an experience that was. Well, maybe not the band, specifically. Can you tell us more about your Hogwarts career? The Sorting Hat didn't take long to put me in Slytherin. A big part of me has always been ambitious, wanting to succeed in the system rather than outside it. I admired Professor Slughorn and wanted to impress him, but unfortunately I was no great shakes at potions. But I did get a lot out of History of Magic. Not necessarily Binns lectures themselves, but being able to tie it into the discoveries I read about in my other textbooks. How the Goblin Wars meant that wizards needed to develop protective charms for their armor, rather than relying on goblin crafters. Magical astronomers refining their techniques after the Muggles discovered more planets at the edge of the solar system. Magical creatures diverging further from their counterparts after the Statute of Secrecy went into effect. I'm glad someone got something out of that class. Then you joined the Auror office. Yes. Knowing what I know now, I'm not sure I'd do it again. But at that point I was ready for a change. Dad liked to say, "You can read every book in the library to learn how things should work, but to find out how they do work, you can't just sit behind a desk." Of course, there was a lot of training, and I spent more time sitting behind a desk than I would have liked, having come out of Hogwarts. How did the Ministry handle Voldemort's first rise to power? As the fact that you have to use the word first goes, not very successfully. A lot of what we were trained to do was hunt down individual criminals. When someone hexes her Muggle neighbors, we need to heal them and modify their memories, then deal with the law-breaking witch and hold her accountable. So when we were dealing with the Death Eaters, most of them were blood fanatics, bigots. Well, we thought, it's just the same thing on a larger scale. We'll send them to Azkaban for a year or two, and that'll show them the error of their ways. But Voldemort himself wasn't just after political power. He had a personal quest to transcend even death itself. I'm not sure there was anything in the ministry that was ready and able to deal with that. Maybe some of the unspeakables. Did anything change after his apparent downfall? Internally, not very much. It's a bit embarrassing, you know. A 15-month-old child has succeeded where we've failed. Do you think we ought to revisit how we're going about things? No, mate, let's party. I'd like to say that I, personally, took advantage of the peace to broaden my horizons a bit. Travel, even get some employment in the Muggle world to see how things were done. But really, I was mostly bored and needed a change of scenery. What were some of the most memorable experiences? I got to attend the Petunia Proudstick's friendly where they drew the magpies. The Montrose Seeker got some criticism for not waiting until her side was ahead to try for the snitch, but that couldn't have come from anyone who saw the match. The Proudstick's chasers were flying rings around their opponents. and there was a bother down in Brazil with some Abraxans whose habitat had been bulldozed. When they're on the ground, some muggles will just take them for regular horses, but it's hard to disguise their aerial courtship behavior. Eventually, you were recruited into the Second Order of the Phoenix. Can you tell us how that came about? After Barty Crouch was shoved aside from the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, I was one of the people who made suggestions as to how we could improve on his shortcomings. Not that we wanted to be lenient toward those blood status ideologues, but we ought to respect people's civil liberties, too. The handling of the Sirius Black case was a disaster on all counts, and I pointed out that there were magical methods we could have tried, Veritas Serum, that sort of thing, when people are maintaining their innocence. Eventually, word of this got to Emmeline, Vance, and she let me in on the existence of the Order. It was awfully brave of her, exposing the paramilitary organization to a straight-laced fellow like myself. Suppose I'd been one of Fudge's lackeys. But I guess I was asking too many questions for that. The Order's loose organization must have been a jarring change of pace for you. It certainly was. But we had Albus Dumbledore for a leader, and he'd been nearly everyone's professor or headmaster at some point, so we all respected him. And I'll tell you, that man could coax the best out of very different people all at once. I mean, he did it at Hogwarts for half a century. More than that, though, I was also on duty as the Prime Minister's clandestine security, so maybe that was enough structure for me. Seeing muggles running around doing things you could have easily handled with magic, did that change your opinion on the Statute of Secrecy?
Good question. The answer is no, not by itself. Because while I was watching Muggle politics by day, the Order was fighting Voldemort by night. It would be tempting to announce that we're coming to the rescue of the Muggles, but once they see that they can barely handle our own problems sometimes, I don't think they'd be quite as enthusiastic.
When did you know you wanted to be Minister of Magic?
About 6 months after I became the interim. No. Once I stepped in, I realized that change wasn't going to happen overnight, and that if we wanted to prevent another Voldemort, wizards, and other magical beings needed to be open to change without burning down the institutions that have served us for centuries, by and large. I can't take credit for the fact that we've mostly had peace since then, of course, but I'd like to think I helped set the tone for thinking in decades, not weeks or months.
Well, let's think short-term for a little. What was your proudest accomplishment of the first year?
Banishing the Dementors. They're powerful beasts. We couldn't have destroyed them entirely, but we were able to subdue them to a heavily guarded refuge whose guards are rotated often for their own health. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of wizards we sent to Azkaban that first year who belonged there, where they couldn't hurt anyone magical or muggle. But no one deserves to be tormented by Dementors.
Do you have any advice you would give to your successors?
If there's one thing ministers have too much of, it's friendly advice from magicians who think they know best, so I'm going to pass on that one.
Your Rottweilers, Maya and Robbie, were well-loved familiars in Wizarding Britain. Do you have any pets these days?
Not unless you count the Jarvie who's taken up residence in my backyard.
It'd be a pity if that most charming smile of yours went to waste. Is there anyone who's, captured your wand over the years?
That information is classified, state secret. Let's put it this way. During the war, particularly the later years, there were many people struggling with their duties and seeking solace from loyal comrades who understood what we were going through, and many of us are still mourning the sacrifices of those years.
Understood. How about a lighter note? Which weekly readers want to know what your favorite breed of dragon is?
Well, there's something to be said for the roar of the majestic Welsh green.
What would you tell a Hogwarts student who dreams of being minister someday?
Well, first I'd remind them that a lot is due to chance. There are plenty of seats on the Wizengamot, and plenty of swotty former prefects out there. But I got my role not because I was the smartest or kindest fellow around, but because I was in the right place at the right time. A place and time we all wish hadn't had to happen. But pay attention to what you learn on the Quidditch pitch. Be ready to move in every direction, work with your teammates, and play fair. And even when it looks like history is made in a single swoop, you don't see the hours of training and preparation that came before.
Kingsley Shacklebolt, thank you so much for your commendable tenure as minister and for joining us today.
My pleasure.
The Quibbler, February 2031. The world of Muggle science is abuzz after the discovery of a recently deceased Diracol corpse. This has led to some overblown anxiety in the magical community. As always, the Quibbler is here to sort out myth from fact and help wizardkind keep cool heads on their shoulders. While Muggles have long been familiar with the Diracol, they were not aware of its apparitional abilities. As such, they believed it to have gone extinct nearly 400 years ago. This was called into question when bus driver Stéphane Rolia came across the remains of a male adult on the eastern shores of Mauritius. Because of its vibrant colors, Muggles at first did not recognize it. However, its condition was such that they knew it must have died within days, rather than centuries, of its discovery. Muggle scientists used a method called DNA analysis to study the bird. Very roughly, this consists of looking inside a creature's body for incredibly small ancient runes. The more similar two species' runes are, the more closely they are related. For example, acromantulas are closely related to common spiders, but less closely related to scorpions. By this process, the Muggles discovered that the deceased bird was closely related to the mundane Makuoko pigeon. Given the location of its discovery and their knowledge of the historical Diracols, they correctly deduced that this was a Diracol specimen. It is important to understand that Muggles still do not realize that the Diracols are magical. Rather, they have realized that a small number of Diracols have survived to the present day, far from human observation. It is likely that they will be vigilant in the months and years to come in searching for living Diracols, particularly on Mauritius, their native habitat. If they catch a Diracol in the process of apparition, this could lead to indirect knowledge of magic. However, since Muggles have no knowledge that Diracols have spread beyond Mauritius due to apparition, they will not be predisposed to interpret birds that they see momentarily elsewhere as Diracols. It should also be stressed that just because DNA analysis is a relatively recent branch of science, that does not make it untrustworthy or fraudulent. Indeed, the Chinese ministry recently employed similar techniques to demonstrate that a gang of black market traders had been breeding dragons in violation of the Warlocks Convention of 1709. Muggles have used this technology to investigate whether two individuals are closely related, for instance in cases of paternity fraud, and wizards could conceivably do the same. Whether this would be condoned socially is another story. Justin Finch Fletchley, a spokesman for the International Confederation of Wizards, has said, "Nonsense about pure blood superiority and magical bloodlines is still far too pervasive in our society. We all know that what begins as idle chatter can lead to hatred and violence. Any use of technology or magic to demonstrate or question magical heritage is unacceptable in our world. What unites us is, and must be, far greater than that which divides us. This is in no way to disparage the remarkable ingenuity of these inventions, but simply to affirm our own limitations." Muggles' belief that the Diracol had gone extinct has led them to be more conscious of the risk human activity poses to other species on the Earth we share, said Daphne Pusey. "It would be a shame if that nobility of spirit were to be squandered because of this accidental discovery. Therefore, for the Muggles' own good, I think we ought to squelch the Diracol once and for all." The Beast Division of the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures immediately disavowed this proposal. "So what if the Muggles do find us out?" cynically mused Shirin Margio, a representative of Mauritius to the ICW. "At the rate their science is going, they might be able to do us a favor or two. Or they'll be too enchanted by the adorable Diracols to worry about us." The Daily Prophet, August 2041. "As a journalist, there are questions I get used to asking. How do you spell that? When exactly did this occur? And there are also questions that the world is used to asking me. Potter? As in..." Sometimes I just let them trail off. Other times I say, "Ginny, the harpy's chaser? Yeah, she's my mum."
because it is annoying, being Harry Potter's kid. It's not as if they're accusing me of nepotism, exactly. Goodness knows, my father wasn't always on the best of terms with the press. If anyone helped me get this job, it's my Auntie Luna, who supported me in my career ambitions since I was 9 and thought writing for the Quibbler would be about the coolest thing ever. It's just being reduced to a footnote, thinking the world understands me. But if I thought I had it bad, it must be far more annoying to be my father, who carried the magical world's hopes and fears on his shoulder since he turned 11 and discovered that world. So here, in his own words, Harry Potter at 60, as interviewed by his youngest child. "In my first year at Hogwarts," Dad says, "I came across an unusual magical artifact." We're on the back porch of the family home in Devonshire, not far from where Mum grew up. It was a mirror that showed the deepest desire of someone's heart, whether they could have named it or not. Professor Dumbledore, Albus, said that the happiest man on earth would look into the mirror and see himself just as he was. But he also said that you could go mad looking at it for too long. He sips a butterbeer and reflects. What I saw was my family. My parents, grandparents, distant magical cousins I'd never met. I'd grown up with my aunt and uncle and cousin, but they didn't look kindly on magic. What I wanted more than anything was a family who would celebrate my magic. And look at me now. Then the aura kicks in. That's not to say they were unpleasant because they were muggles. I mean, magicians can be every bit as prejudiced as muggles, and you oughtn't judge the vast majority of the world just because my uncle was a bit of a prick. It has the feel of a memorized disclaimer, said with the same bored tone he would use when reminding a suspect of their right to silence. I can say, however, that my cousin once removed, Dad half-heartedly tried to get us to call him Uncle Dudley, but with so many real uncles on my mum's side, we never bothered, is hardly the sort of muggle that's likely to endear wizard kind to the lot. What he and Dad share, rather than appearance, demeanor, or any sort of familial resemblance, is a stolid commitment to making the effort, remembering their nieces and nephews' birthdays, requiring us to send polite thank-you notes, even when our lives barely overlap. His eldest plays a mean game of chess, so we at least had that in common. What would you tell that 11-year-old, I ask, if you could give him advice? Grow your hair out, he quips, shaking his unruly bangs. It cuts down on the staring. And a load of advice on how to defeat Voldemort, I reckon. It's a good job we don't have time-turners. This is something that even the frustrations of celebrity don't help me understand. The terror of not only living under a despot, but being expected to handle him single-handedly. At first, I just wanted to teach my classmates to defend themselves, he recalls. Tell them the truth about Voldemort, since the ministry wasn't about to. Once I went on the run, don't get me wrong, it was drudge work. A lot of camping in the middle of nowhere, trying to summon up food without violating Gamp's law, and generally feeling like I had a dementor after me. But there were dozens of Muggleborns on the run, too, who didn't feel like they could take on Voldemort and survive. Feeling like I might be able to do something was more empowering than depressing at that point. He pauses. Of course, I can say that, with 40 years of hindsight. It took me a while, after the war, to figure out how to live. Without having to study for an exam at the end of term, or knowing, well, being pretty sure anyway, there weren't any more Death Eaters after me. At first, I was afraid that fatherhood would be another impossible task, that I'd just have to soldier through because there was no room for failure. Eventually, I realized I had helped create new people who would surprise and delight me as much as anyone else. I'm told all new parents feel that way. He looks uncomfortable at admitting this to me, even now. I assure him that my brothers and I didn't notice his neuroses growing up, and that while we may certainly have been brats on many occasions, that was a function of our immaturity rather than any deficits on his part. It helped to have Molly and Arthur, his parents-in-law, one flew away, he mused. They would tell me that when it was just them and Bill, my eldest uncle, they tried all the tips in Witch Weekly for how to childproof their house.
By the time they had 6 or 7 kids, they'd made peace with chaos. And I guess you didn't turn out too badly, did you? This leads to a maudlin digression on the subject of my late Uncle Fred, a casualty of the Battle of Hogwarts at age 20, which Dad asks me to abridge. He both admires and pities my grandparents for enduring an unthinkable loss, because he's not sure how he could have managed. "I cheated death a half dozen times," he says dryly, "but I never had to worry about how my parents would cope with their child predeceasing them. I suppose that's one advantage to be had." Harry Potter, the Reckless Orphan. Or Harry Potter, the Long-Haired Sexagenarian. Or Harry Potter, actually just another bloke who's still overprotective of his children, even though we're all in our 30s. It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but then neither does Wingardium Leviosa. And as he levitates the pitcher of butterbeer to refill his glass, grinning at some pensive-worthy memory, you sense that not every trace left by his exceptional adolescence is a scar to regret.